hit the record button. So, all right. So Tom and I are going to switch back and forth and talk to you a little bit. There, as Christina said, please use the Q&A and ask questions, but also note we're going to be giving you a lot of information here. So I can't promise that your question will get answered one way or another.
Oh, really quick, Wendy, somebody's already asking if the slides would be available after the webinar.
Yes, they will be.
Okay, I'll let them
know. So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to tell you really a little bit about the Science Foundation. We're going to talk to you about how do you find funding opportunities, and then we're really going to spend the rest of the time talking about how do you prepare a successful proposal. So Tom and I talked about this earlier. You know, remember, as you're looking for jobs, if depending on where you are in your career, we know many of you will be out looking for jobs, and we're welcoming you coming into the community for that. But when you're going to talk about jobs, find out what external support, how much you need, what kind of support you're going to need. You know, proposals really support things like research assistance, your part of your salary, usually up to two months of summer salary, equipment, materials, supply. We have funds for cloud. It might be undergraduates and all sorts of things. So it really helps add on to the abilities of your lab. And most universities, or many of them, are going to expect you to bring that funding in. So find out whether you're going to need that funding early on, because you're going to want to think about that. And remember, NSF is really one of several agencies that support academic research. So, you know, when you're talking to us, you can also ask questions about who else might be funding this. So NSF is an independent funding agency. No, we're not the National Sanitation Foundation, which is what comes up in the searches first. That's not us. We are the National Science Foundation, and we are the country's agency for fundamental science. So we have all of the sciences in one building, and we were established in the 1950s after the war as a way to continue the innovation. And we have about 3,000 employees, and we have program directors that span the entire branches of science. One thing to note is about 40% of our staff are rotators, like Tom. They come, they stay from 1 to 4 years, Tom. Keep the 4 years in mind. But then there are permanent feds like me who came to the government and have worked here ever since. So it won't matter as you're talking to people, but you might find out, oh, somebody from my university was a rotator at NSF. That's a good person to connect with. So our mission is really to promote the progress of science, to advance the national health, prosperity, and welfare, and to secure the national defense. So this was our mission in the beginning, and it really has stayed there. And we really are pushing the frontiers of science and engineering, but we also worry about societal needs, what the research does. You know, how does it get disseminated? What about education? What about outreach? So those are all important things for NSF. Again, we fund both research and education. And as you're talking to program directors and you're talking about initiatives, make sure you understand that balance. But we are talking about basic research in all of our areas of science and engineering. We now have a new Translation and Innovation and Partnerships Directorate that is doing translational research. I'm really sticking to the original directorates at NSF when we're talking here, which the rest of us are funding basic research in science and engineering. So all of us are in one agency, obviously. And remember, at NSF, as in most of the other federal research agencies, we do peer review. So they're based on, we have panels review proposals, program directors manage those panels, they set them up, they manage them. And many of them, again, are current or former faculty. And they use their scientific judgment to help us set the balances and set our portfolios. By the way, if somebody comes from a university, like Tom comes from Virginia Tech, Tom cannot touch anything from Virginia Tech at all. So don't think that because you are still a university faculty that impacts your judgment. You actually don't even get to sit in on a conversation where your university gets mentioned. So we do a lot of things to make sure that we're free of conflicts of interest. So this is NSF by the numbers. You can find this on our website. We do an awful lot of stuff. We're small, but we're mighty. And we had $9.9 billion last year. Hopefully they'll give us more this year. We do about 40,000 proposals a year and fund about 11,000. You know, we defund a lot of institutions, a lot of students, 352,000 people we support each year. And we've had 258 Nobel Prize winners. So we kind of rock the Nobel world. We also get MacArthur Grant people and all sorts of things. So we really, we have an impressive group of PIs. So this is the general organization of the NSF. I'm not going to go through all of this. What I'm really going to tell you is that size is one directorate in the NSF. We have bio, we have size, we have education, we have engineering, geo, MPS, which is math and physical sciences, social behavioral and economic sciences, TIP, which is, I mentioned before. And then we have the budget, finance, and award, and Office of Information and Research Management. They are not research divisions. They are support divisions for the rest of the agency. But your proposal, you know, depending on what you're doing, can be in any one of these directorates. Oops, sorry. So when we come down to size, if we drop down, size has three divisions and one office. So the office is the Office of Advanced Cyber Infrastructure. It's lovingly called OFC. And the Office of Advanced Cyber Infrastructure funds, just as you might expect, infrastructure that helps support the sciences across NSF. After that, we have the three divisions, and these are the research divisions in size. We have CCF, which is our Communication and Communication Foundations. They are really our software and hardware and theory people. We have CNS, which is our computer network systems. They are our networking people, computer systems people, and they like us, do a lot of crosscuts. The final one is us. I think it's the best, but don't tell anybody. Information and intelligence systems. We are really where data, computers, and people come together. So we are the exciting division, and we have lots of crosscuts too. Once you get to IIS, see, it's layer upon layer upon layer. Once you get to IIS, we have three different clusters. These are three core programs. So now Tom comes from our human-centered computing program. Tom, do you want to describe HCC?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, HCC is essentially everything where humans and computers come together. So focusing on things like interfaces and our understanding of how people use computer systems.
And it can be societal impacts, it can be all sorts of things, virtual reality, assistive technology, information integration and informatics does science around how computing works with other disciplines. So they'll do AI, machine learning, but they'll often do it in an area. I came out of the health and computing world where most of the things we've built don't tend to work in those areas. So building new models, new methods to do that, doing databases, doing integration of multimodal systems. Those are all informatics are all a part of our information integration and informatics cluster. And robust intelligence is our more theoretical program. It really looks at making smart systems. So we think about AI, machine learning, robotics, neuroscience, computational neuroscience in there, natural language technologies. So if you're looking at these, look at our website. You really want to look at them. You never want to send an email to every program director. That's a mistake. because actually it's called diffusion of responsibility in the sciences. It means nobody responds if you send it to everyone. So don't do that. Look on the website, see who you think is closest to what you're doing. And then that's where you're going to want to send the emails. So I stole this from Foundational Research in Robotics, which is just one of our important programs in IIS. But you want to look at our web pages. So this is a great example of here's foundational research. This is the kind of things that foundational research in robotics does. So you want to read that synopsis. It's a paragraph or two. You want to read it and you want to say, is that me? Does that fit me? And then you look at program context. So if you notice here too, most of the time you'll send an email to an address, often to an alias like robotics@nsf.gov. That makes sure somebody sees it, because if the person you send it to isn't around that week or is busy that week, we are in the midst of closeout. So like life is crazy right now. So if we have you send them to these alias, so that we make sure that more than one person's eyes are on these, and that that way you get a response. Tom, you want to take over?
Sure. Thanks, Wendy. So really all that is the background to help you understand you're going to have a research project in mind, and you're going to be looking for where you might be able to get it funded. And so understanding that structure of the directorates and the divisions within it helps you understand where it might fit in. But the NSF also has resources to help you find where your research might fit. And so this webpage that's here, and let me put this in the chat so you can look at it. This webpage helps you search for both programs and projects that have been funded, awards that have already been made. Next slide, Wendy. So if you go to that award search, and again, we're stealing this from the robotics bunch. If you search for robotics, it'll pull up a list of the awards that have robotics somewhere in the description. And there's an advanced search too that's available out there if you want to drill down in particular ways. But and then once you get this list of awards, you can click on the grant and get a description of it. Next slide again, Wendy. And so when you click on that particular one, you'll get the abstract for it. You'll also have all the information about it. Actually, I think there's some animation on here, Wendy. Would you go ahead and hit return? Yeah, so you'll get which program funded this award. You'll get which program director is responsible for it. And for a lot of programs, there's multiple program directors, like on one of the earlier slides. And so there's one of us that's primarily responsible for it. And so the way to use this is to look for things that are similar to the type of research that you're doing. And then once you've got a set of those, that'll help you narrow down which program director would be good to contact. Next slide, Wendy. So once you have an idea where your research might fit, it's really important to reach out to a program director. And like Wendy said, don't spam everybody. Don't send email to a whole bunch of people at the same time. It's best to focus on one particular program director or a small set of them if you can't quite tell where your research might fit. But you should prepare a one-page summary and then send that out to the program director that you found. And what happens when I get one of these one-page summaries, and what I think everybody does, is we look at it and go, oh, I know somebody within the program or elsewhere across the NSF that this might be a fit with. And then we send it around internally to have folks take a look at it and provide feedback. It's also totally fine and expected to request a Zoom meeting with the program director and spend a little time talking with us and asking questions. But having that one-page summary helps us give you more detailed feedback and direct you in the right direction. Next slide, Wendy. So since this is a talk for PhD students and postdocs, I wanted to have a slide on funding opportunities for new faculty. So there's the career program, which is aimed at untenured faculty, so folks who are at the assistant professor level. And Wendy, correct me if I'm wrong, it's still you only have three opportunities for career, that's right? So you can only submit to it three times. There's both SAIS and the engineering directorate have research initiation programs. The SAIS research initiation initiative is aimed at faculty who are at non-R1 top level research institutions, say at a primarily undergraduate institution, and also at the beginning of their career. And then we also have this program called EAGR, Early Concept Grants for Exploratory Research. That's actually not limited to just new faculty, but I wanted to make you aware of it. That's for when you have an idea that's probably not ready for a full-blown proposal yet, and it's you can really just work with a program officer to see if they're willing to fund it. And then again, since this is aimed at PhD students and postdocs, this isn't NSF, but it is related. Wherever you, whatever university institution you go to work at, they might have resources to internally support some preliminary work and to help you prepare your proposal. So as you're interviewing, as you get into your new job, you should ask your department, ask your college about those types of resources, because a little bit of internal funding from your institution can help you generate the preliminary work and get feedback on your proposal before it comes to the NSF.
Tom, before we switch slides, we just had a question. I typed a response, but mm-hmm. I just want to echo it because I think right now is a nice time to echo it. Somebody asked, could you send in a project summary in when you have an idea, when you've got this idea and you're thinking it's good, or do you have to wait for preliminary data? And so this is not a paper, this is a proposal. So you don't need preliminary data at NSF. Send that project summary. Don't just slap ideas in there. That's not going to do you any good. Take the time, write an interesting summary of what you plan to do. And if you've never done stuff in this area, make sure you highlight how this team is going to, why is this the right team to do this? Because sometimes nobody's done this and you got adjacent information or skills that are going to make this possible. But people end up asking for preliminary research when it's not clear you can do this. And it's not clear, you know, you've been working in networking all your life and now you decided to go to AI. Why now? So, but yes, you can send a program, you can send a project summary in at any point. Send those summaries in and let people give you feedback on them. So sorry, Tom.
No need to apologize. That was a good point. I actually see a few questions coming in. I'm going to hit the last one because it was a really specific one to the career. I wasn't clear. You have three chances to apply to the career solicitation. So a particular PI can only apply to it three times. So. And then actually there's another question there about the career. What's a suitable time to first try for a career at the second year as an assistant professor? That's a really hard one to answer, and it really depends upon your particular situation. So I'm just going to give you a single data point, which is my particular situation, which is I spent 2 years at one institution before switching to Virginia Tech. And it happened to be right around the time the rules for the career changed. And so I only had one more chance to apply for a career after I switched to Virginia Tech. I waited 3 or 4 years to put that last proposal in and wrote other types of proposals. For other people, if depending upon what you're working on, it might make sense to do it your first 3 years there. So that's really dependent upon your particular situation.
So there's also some questions in here about when can you start applying for proposals? I mean, that's kind of a broad category here. The career is only for tenured tech faculty. So as a postdoc, you should talk to your institution and see what they would let you apply for. That is a university distinction, deciding who can apply for what. I remember in my university, one of our postdocs applied for a large award and got it. And then the university had to make them an offer and keep them for the 5 years of their large project. They were not real happy about that. They didn't think about it ahead of time. Most universities have thought about this and will tell you whether you're eligible to apply. So, but career is for tenure track faculty. So.
And there's a question there as well about starting as an assistant professor next year. And can I start applying for NSF grants before I start next year? Similar sort of answer, that that's really going to be dependent upon the institution that you're starting at as an assistant professor. So for instance, when I made the transition to Virginia Tech, because there was a deadline that was immediately after when I started, Virginia Tech allowed me to had me in their system and had me set up with their office of sponsored projects to be able to submit things. But I think that's going to depend upon the particular university. So.
Check with your institution.
Yeah. So, and actually there's another question about career, trying general NSF first and then career. What's the difference between these two? That's also one of those things that's very context dependent. You'll have to think about it for yourself about what makes sense in terms of the best strategy. Let's see.
There is a question here about what makes, we'll talk about the project summaries again and again. What makes a good one? I would ask at your university who's been funded and asked to see their proposals. The best way you can learn to write proposals is to read as many as possible. The minute you've got your, as minute you're in as a postdoc or you've got started a faculty position, you should be sending in your CV to NSF saying, I'd like to sit on review panel. And make yourself available. When Tom emails you and says, can you be on a review panel? It's kind of amazing. People will say, I really, really want to be in a review panel. Oh, sorry, I can't come. So if you really want to learn about review and you want to read a bunch of proposals, but ask at your university, ask your chair, ask your dean, do you have a repository of funded proposals? Can I see the project summaries?
So jumping back to the slide, I see several questions coming in, but in the interest of being able to get through things, let's jump back to the slides. Wendy, there's a little animation on this one. So we're in terms of prepare. So you've been looking for places to fund your research. You've talked to a program director. Now back to preparing your proposal. If you go to this slide, if you click on this preparing your proposal link, it'll pull up several different things for you to look at: finding the right opportunity, preparing your proposal, submitting the proposal. Next slide, please, Wendy. As you're preparing your proposal, there's several essential documents you need to look at. And the first one is the Proposal and Award Policies and Procedures Guide, the PAPG. And the PAPG governs everything. It provides all the guidance for preparing your proposal and submitting it to the NSF. So it says who can submit the proposals, what's allowed in the budget. It has the format and required documents to go along with the actual heart of your proposal. It also describes the merit review process by which your proposals are going to be reviewed. And we've got a few slides on that later on. And it also provides some reasons why a proposal may be returned without review, which you really, really don't want to have happen. So you really need to look at the PAPG to start understanding what it takes to prepare your proposal. Next slide, please, Wendy. The other thing you need to look at is the solicitation for the program you're submitting to. So this one's from the Division of Environmental Biology. And there's some common pieces here, but it's going to have the deadline and the target date. Some programs actually don't have a deadline. We'll talk about that in a little bit. It's got a synopsis of the program. It'll have a list of the program directors. And so going back to the earlier conversation about who you should contact, let's say you find a solicitation that looks like your research might fit into, you should look at the solicitation for the list of program directors who are on it. It also has things like the eligibility, budget limitations. Some solicitations require that you actually, before you submit a proposal, you have to write a pre-proposal or a letter of intent. And so you really need to know that so that you don't write a proposal for something where you actually earlier had to write a pre-proposal or a letter of intent, so you actually can't submit the proposal. Other things that are in the solicitation are things like how much money is available, how many awards are meant to be expected to be made. Earlier I showed you the PAPG, which has the proposal preparation instructions. Solicitations can have specific things in addition to the PAPG that are required. So there might be supplementary documents. So for instance, some programs require that you have a set of collaborators, you might have a document that describes how that collaboration is going to occur, and so forth. Next slide, please, Wendy. So there are different types of proposals and solicitations. So I just showed you an example of a solicitation. So it's a specific funding mechanism, including some that are pretty general in topic. So for instance, SAIS has core programs that span the whole directorate. And in the other proposals are submitted in response to the PAPG. There's also something called a Dear Colleague letter, which usually announces a focus in some specific funding opportunity with a specific emphasis. And then, like I said earlier, some solicitations have deadlines. Some have target dates. Others have no deadlines at all. So for instance, the SAIS Core Small Program, which is proposals that are less than 600,000, is open all year round with rolling dates. Whereas the mediums in the same core program have a very specific deadline at a certain point in the year, which I think varies from year to year. Next slide, please. So in terms of preparing your proposal, remember that what you're doing with the proposal is you're requesting resources, and usually a lot of resources, to conduct research. The NSF is, if we give you an award, we're making an investment and we'd like to see a return on that investment. So that proposal has to say what you're going to do. It has to justify why it's worth doing. It has to explain how you're going to do it. And also has to say, like, how are we going to know that you were successful when you get it done? And so the whole point of your proposal is to convince the reviewers that your project is worth investing in, okay? That it's worth doing. Next slide.
Can I answer a question that sure. kind of relates to this? So, you know, we really do want you to think about these things, but make sure when you're writing your summary, these are part of your questions in here. There was a question about making a relationship with your program director. Do not send a not fully baked idea. You know, don't say, I want to do AI and this. Can I talk to you? Our folks are busy. They are swamped. They are talking to people that are proposing and people that are not getting funded. You really want to talk to them when you have a project that you need feedback on. Because otherwise, if you send them up a partially baked idea, it's not going to build a relationship. It's going to put a lot of work into a really busy schedule already. And it's not going to help you, because if we don't know what you're thinking before we get on the call, we're going to have to make stuff up in our head when we go. You know, like when I get a request with a question, I very often send it over to Tom or somebody else and say, Tom, take a look at this. This is in my area. Could you talk to this PI? If you send just a not full idea, we can't help you that way. All right. Sorry. Next one, Tom. Are you ready for the next slide?
Oh, yeah. And again, the segue into the next slide is you're trying to convince people that your proposal is worth funding. So one of the things that you should be really familiar with if you submit to the NSF, and this is fully described in the PAPG, is there's two major aspects of review criteria for the NSF. The first one is the intellectual merit, which is the potential to advance knowledge. And then the second one is the broader impacts, which is the potential to benefit society and contribute to the achievement of specific desired societal outcomes. Next slide, Wendy. And so when the reviewers are looking at your proposal, they're trying to assess how that proposal fits with those two criteria. And there are five elements that they're using in judging your proposal. One is, will the work advance knowledge? That's the intellectual merit piece. And will it benefit society? That's the broader impacts. Is the work creative or potentially transformative? Is the work plan sensible? How will they know if they're successful? Remember what I said earlier about declaring success. The fourth one is the team qualified? And then the fifth one is, does the team have adequate staff support and facility resources to be able to accomplish the work? Next slide, Wendy. So a good proposal is going to be structured to address those five review elements. Okay, so it's going to have a compelling introduction and project description that says, you know, what's the statement of the intellectual merit? You're going to want to catch the reader's attention immediately and state up front what you want to do, why it's exciting and important. Okay, and that really gets to research element one. How is this going to advance science? It's really tough as a reviewer to read a page and a half and 2 pages. And by the end of 2 pages, you still don't know what the proposal is about. Okay. As I talk to my PhD students, sorry, this is Tom Martin speaking now, not the NSF. As I talk to my PhD students, I often say more Hemingway, less Hawthorne, right? Like, get to the point, say what you're going to do. You really need to get to that early. The second thing is lay out the specific research questions that you're going to address with the research. Explain the compelling observations, how the work's going to develop and test the hypothesis, okay? And explain why the previous studies have been insufficient to address the question and how your methods are different, okay? And that gets to the research element two, is the work creative and transformative? And then the third bit is explain why your experiment, your model, your setting, your field site, so forth, was chosen for the study, you know, and that gets at the work plan. Next slide, please, Wendy. And then continuing with the work plan, you know, have a timeline with tasks, explain how you're going to analyze or model and how your analysis and models connects to the central questions, okay? Before I go on to the next one, one of the things here is this is research. You haven't done it yet. Okay. So it's a really good proposal. We'll say, well, here's the question we're trying to address. Here's how we plan to go about it. And then also explain some challenges why that approach may not work and what the fallback plan will be if it doesn't work. Okay. So it's usually good for something that might be kind of risky and the outcome's unknown. It'll be good to have a fallback plan. And alternatives that are considered. The next element is, is the team qualified to do this? So if it's not a single investigator, if you're not just writing by yourself, if you've got a team of people, you should explain the specific role of each investigator. If you've worked together before, be sure to say that because it looks really good to have a team that's already been working together and knows how to work together. You also need to show that the work's feasible within the timeline that you say. And I will say, since we were talking about career earlier, I've served on career review panels for, a number of times. A really common failing is in a career proposal is to have too much work to do. The reviewers will go, there's not enough time in the day. In 5 years, they're not going to be able to do all this work. There's just too much here. So you really need to provide evidence you're going to be able to do the work. And then getting at both the work plan and the resources is, do you have the right lab and collaborations facilities available? Include letters of collaboration. And actually there's very specific things about what can go in a letter of collaboration that's described in the PAPG and the money in the budget if needed. A really common failing is to say you're gonna do something and there's nothing in the budget to substantiate that. And then one of the pieces that's described in the PAPG is a supplementary document called the Facilities, Equipment, and Other Resources section. And there you describe the facilities that you have available to you. Use that very wisely and point to particular pieces of your proposal that they support. Next slide, please. So I talked about intellectual merit, which is advancing knowledge. The other piece is broader impacts, which is how your work is going to benefit society. There's a wide range of ways in which a research can benefit society. It doesn't have to do all of these. This is not an exhaustive list, but you should do some of them well. So some broad categories are teaching, training, and learning, undergrad and grad students, K through 12 as well, broadening participation of underrepresented groups in STEM, building or enhancing partnerships internationally or with other agencies, broad dissemination to enhance our understanding of science and technology, enhancing infrastructure, particularly if that infrastructure is not just your infrastructure in your particular little lab, but elsewhere. And then local impacts. And this is policies at state and local level, but it may affect the economy in the local region as well. So next slide, please. So some advice on broader impacts. There's no formula. This is advice that I've taken from elsewhere. What you should do is something that interests you, that has measurable outcomes, and it matches the time that you're willing to devote. Remember what I said earlier about really common failing of career proposals is there's just too much promise and not enough time to do it. So make sure you're willing to devote the time to it that it's going to take. The other thing is it should go above and beyond what you're already paid to do. So as a faculty member, you're going to be paid to teach a class. Lots of times you'll see a proposal that has a broader impact. It's like, well, we're going to add this to a particular course, or it's just this little bit of a course that I'm going to tweak. Well, that's not much of a broader impact. You're already teaching that class. And like I said earlier, it's better to have, you know, one or two really strong impacts than a bunch of smaller perfunctory ones. So a few believable impacts is much, much better than having promising a wide range of things and not being able to do much on any one of those. The other thing is, if your broader impact requires money to do it, you should ask for the money. Again, a common failing proposal is to say you're going to do something in the proposal, but then the budget doesn't back it up. If you need the money to do something, be sure that it's there in the budget. And if you're using an existing infrastructure, you should use an existing infrastructure as appropriate, but make sure that you're contributing to it as well as utilizing it. And a really good example of this is, like, lots of times you'll see broader impacts where it's working with K through 12. Make sure that it's not going to be a burden on the partner school. And actually, if your university already has a program where they're partnering with particular K through 12 schools, take advantage of that, but add to the existing program. Okay. Another bit of this is ask for help with assessment. For many, many years, I've worked with somebody in engineering education, and the educational efforts that we've had, we would find an external evaluator to help with the assessment of what we were doing. And there's a link here in the slides. Maybe we can put these in the chat so that people can take a look at it. So next slide, please.
No, let me say something.
No, Wendy.
Christina will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe in September, isn't it ARIS, Christina?
Is it what?
September office hours, aren't we doing?
Oh, yes, that was, yes, correct.
So September, our office hours in IIS in September are all about broader impacts. So it's really, I'm partnering with ARIS, which is ARIS. Can't remember what ARIS is off the top of my head, but
I will post a link.
Oh, perfect. ARIS has been funded by NSF to help people develop their broader impact identity. So kind of help you think about the things that are part of your broader impact that really are consistent with who you are and what you want to achieve. So some people are really into one area and not others, but as Tom's noted, you really want to have a few believable impacts, and that's what's important to you. So if you're broadening participation, if you are doing outreach, everybody has their own thing that really excites them. We want you to really be excited by that, but come to the September office hours with ARIS and learn more about how to write really great broader impacts.
Before you go to the next slide, Wendy, let me give one concrete example of what you just said. So my successful career proposal, my background's in electronic textiles. So I put electronics into fabric, trying to turn that into smart clothes. At the time I wrote my career proposal, I'd actually contacted the last of the big textile mills in Virginia, in South Central Virginia. And I had a letter of collaboration from them that said they would weave my next batch of fabric and would work with me, you know, because they saw it as a way to improve their commercial possibilities. I did it as so. I didn't think it would be that important, but it was one of the things almost every reviewer of my proposal mentioned. And it was a broader impact in terms of it was a chance to sort of revitalize the textile industry in that part of the state. Now, it didn't pan out because of the way industry went after that, but it was, it's not the kind of impact that, it wasn't a generic broader impact. It was very specific to what my proposal was about. Next slide, please. So changing gears a little bit, just trying to give you an idea of what the review process looks like. And I believe this figure is from the PAPG. It's certainly up on the NSF website and close to the PAPG if it's not in the PAPG. So there's really three phases to the life cycle of a proposal. So the first phase is an opportunity gets announced, a solicitation is published, and it's usually 90 days before at the deadline. So you work on the proposal, you submit the proposal. You can't submit the proposal directly. You have to go through your university. So you'll put all the documents up and then your university's office of sponsored projects or whatever they're called will actually submit it for you. So the proposal will be received at the NSF. And then from the time it's received, the second phase usually takes about 6 months. It might take a little bit longer, but we try to get reviews done and an answer back to the investigator within 6 months. So we get a pile of proposals in, we look at what their topics are, we find reviewers who have expertise that cover those topics, then we set up panels with those reviewers based upon the feedback that we get from the reviewers. The program officers make recommendation to our bosses. So Wendy is my deputy director, and then we have a director. So I, as a program director, I make a recommendation. It goes up to Wendy and Michael, and then they either go along with my recommendation or turn it down. And so that's the division director review. And then assuming it gets awarded, then it goes into award processing where there's a business review. And then finally, the award gets finalized, which might take another month. Next slide, please. Or Wendy, if you want to jump in on anything that I've said there, that's fine too.
No, I think the important thing to remember is this is about a 6 month process. If you keep an eye on you know, research.gov, see what's happening. We're trying to get these things out as quickly as we can, but it's just remember it's a 6 month process.
Yeah. And along the lines of what Wendy said earlier, and I said earlier about not spamming the program directors, don't send mail to a program director after 2.5 months after you've submitted your proposal, because it's going to take that full 6 months to get through and review everything. So slightly more detailed view of the middle part of that. On this slide, you know, you've got your idea, that's the light bulb there. Your university submits that to the NSF through research.gov. It goes to a particular program. There's actually a couple different ways that it can be reviewed. One is, and at least in terms of size, the most common way is setting up a panel. So there'll be a couple of days, we'll bring a bunch of reviewers together with a bunch of proposals. Each one will be assigned a number of proposals to review. We'll have discussions of them. So that's a panel review. The other possibility is something called an ad hoc review, where each proposal gets a set of three or more reviewers, but they don't meet as a panel, but they still get reviewed. The recommendations from those reviewers come to the program officers, and then based on those recommendations and what the portfolio looks like of what we've been funding, we make a recommendation. And that recommendation goes to the division director for their concurrence. If it's a decline, then that goes directly to the organization. If it's a recommendation for an award, then it goes to DGA, the Division of Grants and Awards, who does the business processing of it, and then they make the award to the organization. So next slide, please. Whoop. So
I need to do this one since I spent my whole life here.
What's that?
Well, I mean, yes, to do this one because I spent my whole life here.
Go.
So you've got an idea. So you're going to talk to a program officer again. Talk to the program officer. Send a project summary. Why do we keep saying send a project summary? Tom is laughing over there because project summary is the absolute first thing anybody reviewing your proposal reads. And honestly, that's how they get sorted into review panels. You wouldn't believe how many proposals have really poor project summaries. I have no idea what they're doing. The whole project summary talks about the problem. It doesn't talk about the science they're addressing. So, you know, I've led the Smart Health program for a while. So they start with EHRs are challenging to use and doctors don't understand them. And we're just going to make them more useful. Well, that's lots of people have done more useful, like useful for who and how and what are you doing? So you really want to talk about the scientific questions that you're hitting. You know, what are the things blocking the usefulness, the usability, the explainability? What are the things that you're trying to do? But when people don't write that project summary early, when they slam it together the night before that proposal goes in, you know how good it is? Not great. Write it early and revise it often. That should be something you do because the program officer is going to give you feedback. Are they going to want to talk to you? Do they want to see your slide deck? No, they do want to talk to you, but they don't want to see your slide deck. They do not have an hour to talk with you. They usually have about 15 minutes to talk to you about your idea. If we have your summary, we can read what you wrote. That helps us think about how you write about what you're doing. Because I often get people on the phone and then they say, oh, no, what I'm trying to do is this. It helps me to understand how you're framing what your problem is. What are you trying to do scientifically? So write that project summary, put that idea into writing, send it to your program officer, get feedback. You may need preliminary results, but again, we don't require preliminary results. So what we require is for you to demonstrate that you and or your team, well, you and your team, if you have a team, are qualified to do this research. So did you do this project before? No. But did somebody else, did you work in this area before? And you know, you're an expert in this area, but you never worked in this area before, but you got somebody on your team that works in that area. You don't need preliminary data. What you do is need to convince people you all have the expertise. So you're gonna do the submission. It's gonna go to merit review. Again, that's about a 6-month time. Sometime in that thing, you'll either get an email from the program officer saying, I'm interested in potentially funding this. They will ask you questions. They will ask you for if you answer the question. By the way, if anybody ever asks you to answer questions, don't get snarky. People have blown awards by not fully answering those questions. It's kind of an amazing thing. I'm sure you're all smarter than that, but I have seen very senior people kind of go, well, I'm not sure why you didn't understand what that was. Well, guess what? It doesn't get you an award. If I'm writing a question, then I have a question. I've read your proposal and I want to know the answer to it. So take the time, answer those questions correctly. We usually give you a week, sometimes less, depending on what time of year it is. But take the time and write a good response. If that happens, then we'll be asking for abstracts and all sorts of things. If it's a decline, get your decline, read all your reviews, read everything, talk to your friends. Do not send the email right away. And by the way, when I process a decline and you respond to everybody on the email, what a jerk they are at NSF. Please note, we all get that email. I don't care if you think, I'm sorry you're unhappy. It doesn't hurt my feelings. I understand. I've been on the client side of an award before, a proposal before. But I have many, many, many very, very embarrassed people who have to then feel like they send an email to say, sorry, didn't mean to call you a jerk. So realize that everybody is on that decline. But once you get that decline, take a week or two, talk to others, read it again, let the anger go, subside. I know it's you've got strong feelings because this is you. And then talk to your programming officer again and modify the idea and work from there. Remember, if you're getting a project, a panel summary, sometimes we don't do panel summaries, but often we do. If you get a panel summary, use that as the guide for the changes that you're making, because the panel summary highlights the things people agree on. Remember, reviewers are not perfect, and they're not all identical. So Tom and I read the same proposal, and Tom says, oh, I really like this, this, and this. I read the same proposal and go, yeah, those are interesting, but you know what? They really miss this. It doesn't mean that they're not, they don't, it may be one is more relevant than another. It might be during discussion that somebody says, Wendy, I think you're completely wrong, and this is why. And then I say, okay, yeah, and maybe adjust my review. But the thing is that we're not identical. The panel review, it really gives you the feel of what everybody was talking about and where people were. All right, Tom, here you go.
And actually, before I jump into this, I want to double down on something Wendy said, which is when I got here in January, I started to realize how important the project summaries were. I had no idea over the years how they were used. So I can't emphasize enough, write a good project summary. They get used in so many ways. And if nothing else, they're the first impression that the reviewers get of your proposal. So some tips, read the funding announcement, read it closely. Read it again and again and again. Mark up the PDF, print it out and mark it up. Make sure you have everything in there that the funding announcement that the solicitation requires. Talk with the program director. Find one who's you know, on that particular solicitation. If a whole bunch of them are listed, try to figure out which one seems most closely aligned with your particular research that you're planning to submit. Contact them, like we've said. Read the PAPG. Make sure you have everything in there that you need. Pay meaningful attention to broadening participation. Emphasize both the NSF merit review criteria, intellectual merit, and the broader impacts. And actually, I often get asked by reviewers, like, which one's more important, intellectual merit or broader impacts? It's like, neither one's more important than the other. That balance is up to the individual proposal and the individual reviewer. So if what you're doing has is more transformative in terms of broader impact, be sure to emphasize that. If it has more potential to be transformative in terms of intellectual merit, be sure to emphasize that, okay? Start early, work with your institution's sponsored research office to make sure you meet their deadlines. So if an NSF, so using Virginia Tech as an example, I have a series of deadlines working backwards from the NSF deadline where I have to have certain pieces of paperwork in at certain amounts of time before the proposal has to be submitted. If I don't meet those internal deadlines, they may not actually submit my proposal, in which case you did a whole bunch of work and it doesn't do any good. Next slide, please.
So we only have a couple of minutes left. I just wanted to put that on your radar.
Yep.
Thanks, Tom.
And we've got two slides. So one thing, since the audience is PhD and postdocs, a really common mistake for new faculty is writing proposals as if they're papers. Papers are about what you've already done. Proposals are about what you would like to do. It's a different type of evidence, okay? So you have to convince the research worth doing, and you have to convince the reviewer that your proposal is worth doing than the other proposals that are being reviewed. And really get some advice from somebody who's outside your lab. Get them to read your proposal before you submit it, well in advance of submitting it. Next slide, please. Last bit of advice, help the reviewers, okay? So you're writing to reviewers who are your peers, but this is broadly defined. They're not going to do exactly your little specialty, okay? So make sure that what they're looking for is easy to find particularly in terms of intellectual merit and broader impacts. Don't assume that the reviewers know all your jargon. Again, they may not be in your very particular subspecialty. And make sure the most important things receive the most space. So the contribution and the plans. And I can't say it enough, work on your one-page project summary. Spend a lot of time and a lot of care on that because that's the first impression that your reviewers are going to get. So
So I do think we have gotten more questions about egress, which are really common. Egress are not easy. For whatever reason, people feel like egress are easy to get. I think it's because they say we fund 100% of our egress, but that's because everybody that gets an egress talked to us before they sent in an egress.
Right.
And they got encouraged to submit an egress. And even then, I don't think it's 100%. Egress are only high risk, high reward. You shouldn't be able to do it in another solicitation or another program. So if you say, oh, I want an egress because, you know, I haven't done this before, that's not going to get you an egress. You know, you're in an area that you say this is super high risk, high reward, and nothing fits for it. So, all right, we will be posting the video of this on the website. And I know we are a minute over, Christina, and I'm sorry because we usually try to be better than that.
It's okay. I appreciate all the information. And I know there are some questions that didn't get answered. And hopefully some of them were answered through the discussions and the slides that you guys had. And just to clarify really quickly, this will be under the events where we post the webinars, correct, Wendy?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. So we'll for those of you who are asking specifically about that, please, I put some links in our chat if you want to grab them quickly before we close the webinar. But I would keep tabs on IIS's office hours if you just type that in the search engine on NSF. It should take you to the right site, and we should have those slide decks and the recording posted up there. I do want to thank our panelists and, of course, our attendees in particular for being here today. I certainly personally feel like I could talk for 2 more hours, but obviously that's not going to happen. So again, thank you everybody for being here. Please continue to attend these office hours as much as you can. Sometimes they're not maybe directly related to this topic, but that you might still find useful information. So other than that, thank you so very much. And as I said, we have these monthly. So every Thursday of every month, third Thursday of every month. So keep an eye on that, on those office hours. Thank you once again. And I will see you guys next time. Bye.
Thanks to Christina for making these things happen.
Yes, I was going to say the same thing. Thanks, Christina.
Yeah, thank you.